This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You are tuned in to the Evening Edition. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and we're celebrating BFM's 10th birthday. In this hour, we'll be looking back at the station's first venture in lifestyle and culture programming outside our core shows that at the time were still largely to do with business. We'll also be showcasing some shows that are one of a kind and also talking about how we create radio programs to talk about things that are usually more visual in nature. So let's rewind the clock. The year was 2010, and on the weekends, the only thing on BFM's airwaves were songs, just music. Realizing the potential of that massive real estate, one of our former producers, Shifa Situ, decided to start a new department in the station, exploring, well, just about anything but business and finance. Two of the earliest members of the team, Ali Johan and Richard Bradbury, recap that journey.
Do you want to start off?
I can do.
You were here a month before I was?
Yes. And when I joined, our previous supreme leader, Shifa Situ, was already a producer at BFM. So she was probably working in another belt, but floated the idea to our boss and our programming lead about having programs on weekend. And this was probably 2010. At that point, BFM had been 2 years old and did not have any programming on Saturday and Sunday.
Right.
So it was just music up to that point, and then we started the belt with four programs, and the idea behind it was probably to provide programming outside of the business content that we already have Monday to Friday.
Yeah. It was kind of seen as a bit of a break from the norm, you know. You've got all your business programming Monday to Friday, and we looked at it as a way of like, people need a break. You know, you need something a little bit different that isn't just stocks, shares, hardcore current news. We wanted something a bit different.
And also with media, if you look at other formats, newspapers or magazines like Time or The Economist or even newspaper dailies, you always tend to have that pull-out segment. And we thought it could be that. Programs that exist outside of the business sphere.
But still inside the newspaper, so to speak.
Process, technically, we were just a small team of three people, Richard, myself and Shifa.
Yeah.
And we would get contributors from other belts who would have, like, for instance, the news program were run by the news editors themselves.
They would come to us with stories that they wanted to talk about. Mm. But also to kind of go back to what you were saying about how we approached it, whether or not we had people coming to us regularly, and you always get people outside of a radio station saying, oh, I think I have an idea and I'd like to do this. And so the weekend belt became that kind of almost like a training ground or test bed for some of these ideas that went on to become, you know, bigger and better things. But yeah, the initial point, we sat down, the three of us, and we threw a whole bunch of ideas together, what would work and what couldn't work, what was sustainable and what wouldn't be. I mean, if you look back over the history of the Weekend Belt, you'll see that there became shows that became like serialized almost. You know, they appeared in a season and then stopped or continued depending on how popular they were. And that was because some of it was based around people who could contribute at certain periods but couldn't at others.
So the Weekend Belt started with four shows. We had What the Flick, the earliest iteration of what you may now know as At the Movies. There was The Week in Review, a news aggregator and current affairs show. I Love KL, a cultural exploration of the people and places in the city that is still on, still running. And also that music show now known as Wavelength. I'll let the boys walk you through each of them.
You're listening to WTF, What the Flick, BFM's new movie show presented by me, Uma Fagan and Johanan Sen, self-professed movie experts. WTF, What the Flick is a weekly show dedicated to all things film. Join us now for our inaugural show where we will give you our predictions for the BAFTAs, a precursor to the Oscars, which we will talk about in 2 weeks' time. So let's take you into the BAFTAs. The question, I guess, is...
What's the point?
Does anyone really care about the BAFTAs?
Well, they do because, I mean, you look at the BAFTAs to figure out what shows aren't going to win for the Oscars.
And, you know,
essentially, it's a movie review show and then have a topical discussion in the second part of the show. I'm sure it was from Uma himself and Johanan Sen, the presenter, producers. But we started to experiment with more visual programs, see? Like a radio show talking about movies is quite hard to pull off initially, we thought. So in the early days, I remember us using the trailers and, you know, scripts from the movie, excerpts from the movie, that sort of things, to give it more effect. But then, obviously, it's grown now. If you listen to At The Movies today, it's come a long way from how we did What The Flick. But that was a need for it. I feel there was a following of movies, with our listeners at least.
The Week in Review on BFM 89.9, the business station.
The Week in Review, a news recap program, which also had other components of news from the internet and also the incident room, which is more of a fleshed out discussion about a big topic. What we would hear now on today's talkback, for instance, we broke it down on the weekend for a bit longer. And that was the intention of that, you know, speaking to people in the know, people in the scene of current affairs.
BFM 89.9, this is the Incident Room on Saturday, March the 13th, with me, Tiffany Chu, and Pravin Karan. And joining us today are Pramesh Chandran, CEO of Malaysia Kini. We also have Un Yeo, the Edge New Media Editor. Today, the Prime Minister, Dato' Sri Najib Tun Razak, is hosting a tea party for his online fans. In light of that, we're exploring how leaders today are embracing social media tools in their communication strategies. First off, let me ask the two of you to set the context by telling us how this medium has evolved in the Malaysian political context. Prem?
I think we've seen a huge growth of the use of new media. First, prior to 2008, mainly by the opposition, and then after the election.
I love KL. I love KL. I love KL. I love KL. BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to I Love KL. Today, our main act is the play Giraffes Can't Dance, which is being performed by the British theatre company Blunderbuss at PJ Live Arts Centre until the 20th of March.
Every time I stand, I fall right down. Everywhere I go, I seem to be the clown.
And I Love KL, again, a program that would give our listeners an insight about things that we value as journalists, as producers.
And stuff about parts of the city that you don't necessarily know, but would like to know more about.
Yeah.
The clock tower story, for example.
Yeah.
You know, there's some guy who's been looking after a clock tower in KL for how many years?
Mm.
You know, and it's something you'd never even think about. You know, you probably drive past it regularly. But it's like, well, what's the story behind that? You know, and so you'd find out a little bit more about the history of the city that we live in, you know, and how it's kind of expanded and flourished and which parts of the city are being looked after and which have been gentrified. It just became almost like a love story to KL in the end.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it still does to a degree. You know, it's we all live here. You know, we all have to deal with its ups and its downs and its bad traffic and its bad smells. But at the end of the day, we stay here for a reason. And I think I Love KL was a way of kind of saying to people, you know, we love KL for these particular reasons. Maybe you should give it a chance.
I'm curious to know whether or not people are actually interested in history, or perhaps it's just hard to find the right information.
It's hard to find, but the material does exist. I am presently writing a book, which is Histories of Malaysia, which is looking at the histories from a bottom-up as opposed to a top-down. It's not a great man history. I'm not interested in the sultans and the politicians, but more in a people's history. Therefore, I think being here on the ground is a good way of starting that.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to That Music Show. Today we're speaking to singer-songwriter Azmil Younor. So I understand you have a day job and that you're a lecturer in communications, media studies and performance art. So how did you actually get into music in the first place?
Well, I mean, first time I played piano as a kid, having that sort of middle class background. So, but then I learned guitar. Piano wasn't my thing because you're playing scores by dead people, so there's no point. So I felt the urge to write songs only maybe I was about 16, 17.
Yeah, that was just a focus on the local sound because it was a time, 2010, where, you know, the acceptance of local music had gone on to greater things with, you know, the successes of Malay singing bands, you know, Butterfingers, Hujan, OAG type time. So we decided to pander that way and look at our, you know, talents in the country, and we interviewed a bunch of local bands. I remember having Azmil Yuno on the first episode, and then eventually going around the scene to see the sounds that we like.
I've got a fan on the window frame, turn around facing east where the sun goes down, the smoke files out in orderly fashion.
And that's a brief summary of the stories behind the weekend team's first shows on BFM. Coming up, we look at some of the stories that were the first of their kind on our airwaves. You're listening to BFM's 10th birthday special on BFM 89.9.
Take some time, I'll take a minute to make a clean slate. So why won't you come?
You are listening to the Evening Edition with me, Lee Chui Lin, and you're also listening to our special 10th year birthday programming. And now we're bringing you episodes that are, we like to think, the first of their kind, episodes that add on the weekend supplement belt over the years. Now, being pre-recorded shows, flexibility and creativity were essential in the process to think outside the box. Unplanned and spur-of-the-moment shows usually turned out to be our favourites. For instance, once we turned the tables and tried beating scammers at their own game. Scam emails are a nuisance most of the time, we know that, but we try to make the best of it by turning something really annoying into something entertaining. In this story, Reverend John Paul is a religious man on his sickbed with $25.5 million to share. A lot of money, so obviously we were very intrigued. We went undercover, posing as a fellow reverend to get behind his true intentions. Here is a snippet of that story from an I Love KL episode in early 2015.
He requested for details like my full name, my email address, and my location so that he could proceed with the supposed transaction.
$25.5
million.
$25.5 million.
I had to spell out my fake email address to him, but I was pretty sure that he already had it and he was acting like he didn't.
P-A-U-L-I-I-M. L, another L? Okay, L-I-M? Yeah, okay.
Since we were on the subject of emails, I used that opportunity to, you know, ask him about his email that used a free web-based email service provider instead of an official email for the Commercial Bank International based in Dubai. So he claims that he's a banker and he has the rights to have a private email.
I am a banker and I also have the right to have a private email.
Yes, I mean, that's true. But if you are overseeing a transaction of $25.5 million, you wouldn't send out your private emails.
But
right?
Let's just take a moment to appreciate the brilliance of Mr. Bassam Samira's comeback line. I mean, of course you have the right for a private email. After Mr. Bassam's great line of defense, I proceeded with my last question. Are you Reverend John Paul?
And at this time, did you really think that he was Reverend John Paul?
It was pretty obvious.
I am not. I am Bassam Muhammad. How can I be working in the bank and be Reverend Paul also?
He sounds pretty nervous there.
Yeah, as you can tell from his voice, he tried to defend himself, claiming that it is impossible for him to be working in the bank and being Reverend John at the same time.
Which makes me wonder, are these people actually ready for replies? I mean, he's basically on the premise of offering free money, right?
I think he thinks that we are pretty stupid, lah.
Yeah, so he assumed that we won't ask any questions and kind of, okay.
So after my delightful conversation with Mr. Bassam Samira, I received the form from him through email, and it was a scanned copy of the Commercial Bank International's form for fund transfers. It looked very sketchy and it was blurred out, and there were the words original copy pasted on the left side to, you know, add the touch of authenticity.
No forms does that, right?
Yeah, I mean, it looks so unprofessional. Come on. After some Googling, I realized that the Commercial Bank International is a real bank in Dubai. So I decided to give the bank a call to find out the legitimacy of this supposed transaction. I spoke to a phone operator and she said that the bank would never send out fund transfer forms over email.
For a bank will never send you an email to transfer fund to any account or something like this. We don't email you for this purpose. You can ignore it. Receive an email on that email basis you're calling, you can ignore that email.
So it was a fake form?
It was a fake form. So I emailed Reverend John Paul again to tell him that I've made the call to Mr. Bassam, but I had doubts about him as he seemed pretty unprofessional over the line.
Okay, so prior to this, all this time you have been in that sense cooperating with him, you know, saying very nice words to each other, and then suddenly you just dropped in and him say, "I'm suspicious," right?
Mm-hmm.
Did he react differently after that?
Okay, to my amusement and laughter, Reverend John claims that he himself had doubts about Mr. Bassam and he suspected the dubious character in him.
So at this point, we think that Reverend John and Mr. Bassam are the same person.
They are the same person.
But one is, you know, in a sense, talking down on the other.
Yeah. Reverend John then told me that he will make an alternative arrangement and he will get back to me. So I continued to pursue Reverend John Paul's number. I insisted that I wanted to speak with him on the phone. But he insisted that he's under strict doctor's orders not to use the telephone.
Telephones are bad, but, you know, laptops are okay.
Emails are alright, apparently. And he then gave me another contact number, and he said that it was the number of his nurse, and I can try to call this number, but doubts that the nurse would allow me to get on the phone with him.
So, you called the number, right?
Of course I did.
To copy this tune, press 1. You have all it takes to be better. You have all it takes to be smarter. Everything you need.
And he hasn't contacted you since, right?
Nope.
That was a snippet from an episode of I Love KL, examining scam emails. Moving on, a bit of culture. It's a long-running show and one of the flagship programs on the Destination Belt, and every week it sees a panel of three who discuss the current happenings and trends in the world of culture. However, sitting in a doubt studio isn't always the most conducive space for good conversation, no matter how interesting the topics, so sometimes we try recording somewhere else. For example, the To Soon Cafe, famous for its toast and homemade Hainan coffee in Georgetown, Penang.
One of the things that I've often found with Penang is if I go on my own searching for food and I find something which I think is pretty good, I report back to a Penangite. I am always told, "Oh, you went to the wrong place." And now I feel paranoid being in Penang. I always feel like it's just better somewhere else. I'm, you need a guide.
And that's the nice thing about your city, is that you know when it's really your city, when you can be a guide. When you have this thing worked out in your head. You have a guest and you're going to show them the most interesting
places. But you know that your city is really bad when you're a guide and you've got nowhere to take them.
Yeah,
there's nothing to show them.
But no, maybe you don't love your city.
Maybe.
But to get back to this idea of food, do you find KLites do the same thing? Where you say, "Hey, I just, you know, I had Hokkien Mee somewhere," and someone goes, "No, you went to the wrong place."
Yeah,
or are we not spoiled for choice enough?
That place is. And by the way, Uma, this is my show. I should be asking the questions.
Staying with the outdoors, the advantage of pre-recorded programs is that they also give us room to play and to spice up shows with ambient sounds to bring the listening experience right to the ground. One of the episodes of I Love KL sees Richard Bradbury tackling the hustle and bustle of Chinatown.
So moving on, we should be heading down to what was the Grocers Association building, which is located at number 78. Let's see if we can find that. Oh, he's gonna. No, no. Yeah. All I need to know is how long has he been cutting hair here?
Where you came from?
I'm from England, but our radio station is here in Malaysia.
Radio station?
Ah.
Which radio station?
BFM.
BFM?
Ah.
But You don't understand English.
All I want to know is how long he's been cutting hair, you know, and how has it changed around here?
He can't speak English. How should I say in his head?
So he doesn't want to say how long he's been cutting hair?
More than 50 years.
50 years?
Yes.
Wow. You must have seen a lot of changes around here then. Okay. Right then. So after our failed attempt at interviewing a barber who's apparently been cutting hair around here for the last 50 years, we're now stood outside number 78, which was originally the Grocers Association building. It's a three-story building, and it's actually pretty well preserved. Right now, it's run by an optical company, and on the side of the building, there's the digits 1931, which I assume is when this building was put up. From what we are told, it's one of the best examples of a late Straits settlement, eclectic-style architecture. And again, as you can hear, it's incredibly noisy. But try doing an interview down here where there's no sound whatsoever. It's difficult.
Seeing how newspapers have opinion pieces, we also decided to open up a platform for creative, thought-provoking monologues. And one of our favourite pieces over the years is one where Lim Soon Heng tells us his theory about recycling newspapers and recycling the news.
When I first returned to the country, after being away many, many years, one of the sounds of the city that arrested my attention was this. The call of a vendor of old newspaper, buying for recycling purposes. I still hear the cry on weekends, though less often. Perhaps it's because I live in a condominium. We apartment dwellers take recyclables to collection centers or toss them into the community bins with the hope that the promised recycling happens. Almost everyone I know neatly stacks their old newspapers. When the pile is high enough, their ears are peeled to catch the call of the vendor. When he comes by, and invariably it is a he, a middle-aged Chinese man in a small truck, housewives or young children call out from the front door, "Old newspaper, old newspaper," always twice. Just like how you tell someone to walk down the road, or that it rained very hard. The vendor is called old newspaper, as though that is his given name. He weighs them, calls out how much there is, and then with the speed of an electronic calculator arrives at the payment, tells you, then counts out the amount.
That was Lim Soon Heng on an episode of I Love KL. Coming up, we dive into the thought process of translating visual elements into audio form on the weekend supplement. I'm Lee Chui Lin on the Evening Edition. You are tuned into our special 10th birthday programming right here on BFM 89.9, the business station. You are listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and today we are taking a look at, it's our 10th anniversary, and basically we're doing special programming all day. Now we're diving into the wonders of what our weekend programming has to offer. I'm going to let Othniel Ting and Adeline Chung take it away.
When it comes to radio shows, the sky's the limit. You can do a show about crime, politics, the economy, pets, and so much more.
But there's a certain category of shows where radio stations try to avoid because, well, it's a bit tricky, right?
Yeah. You know, if we compare it to the TV where we have the advantage of sight and sound, radio, on the other hand, relies very heavily on just the sounds that you hear. Mm-hmm. And with that disadvantage being present in radio, we just have to hope that listeners have ample information, either in the words or the sound effects that we provide, to steer the imagination of the listeners towards the right direction.
That's right. So then comes the question, how do you run a show with a highly visual topic on radio where you are stripped of all visual guide? How do you do a food show without showing our listeners the dishes? Or a fashion show without showing people the clothes?
Very good question. My name is Othniel.
And my name is Adeline.
We're here to dig deeper into the thought process of doing highly visual shows on radio without the aid of visuals. Sure, still sounds impossible, right, to most radio stations, I would assume.
That's right. But clearly, BFM isn't just any radio station. Throughout 10 years of running as a station, we have a couple of highly visual shows on air. Now, our latest baby would definitely be our car show, Cruise Control.
Now, when you think of car shows, there are a few that immediately comes to mind, right? You have Top Gear, Fifth Gear, and Grand Tour, to name a few. But for radio, probably not. You know, I can't even think of one. And as car buyers, we are heavily influenced by what we see with our eyes and what we touch with our hands. So, you know, it's a show that relies very heavily on visual guides to show the latest models, the latest innovations and more. So how does Cruise Control do it?
So we spoke to Daniel Fernandez, co-host of the program, to find out more. These days, cars come in all kinds of shapes and sizes, besides the generic things like the color, the height, and more. So how do you find the best words to give listeners a visual idea or guide of the car you're talking about?
It's actually quite challenging to try and get a listener to understand what we're trying to explain when they can't visualize it. So we do get people, you know, coming back to us after listening to the show and saying things like, yeah, but when you explain, you know, the lines of the car or, you know, the way the dashboard flows, we can't imagine it. So we always refer back to our website for them to come and get a visual experience. That's the most we can do. Of course, with TV, it's a lot easier. But with TV, your reach is limited. In the car, people listen to the radio, and we're right there and we're immediately able to share the information with them.
How do you decide what car jargons are deemed too technical for the mass audience?
Car jargons over the years have become a little bit ridiculous, I think, because over the years, a lot of people have also created new jargons. The easiest way to look at it is this. I try and use simplified English. I don't use car jargons as much as possible, simply because by using car jargons, you're inviting the listener to switch off. Because if I'm talking to someone who's not a car person and I start using too many car jargons, they'll say, I don't understand what this presenter is talking about. I'm going to turn the channel because I even though I love cars, I don't understand what he's talking about. But if you use simplified English, simple, straightforward points, imagine now you're talking to a 17-year-old who wants to buy his first car, who has never read a car magazine, never gone to a car website. How do you explain to them? You explain to them in simple English, and that's the way to do it. Let me explain it in this way. For example, Newton meters, torque. If you say, oh, this car has got 400 Newton meters of torque, the average person will think, what is he talking about? So we don't say 400 Newton meters of torque. We say there's enough power to push this car like a freight train, which produces 400 Newton meters. That's the definition of it. If you say 200 brake horsepower, they'll say, okay, how do you explain that? That's the kind of power that delivers a 0 to 100 acceleration. So you need that power figure. So a low power figure will come from, say, a Perdua Asia, which is 89. A high power figure of 210 will come from a Volkswagen Golf GTI. So immediately the listener will understand, oh, Perdua Asia, not so powerful. Golf GTI, I've seen it zoom around, quite powerful.
Is there a difference with your choice of words for print and for radio, since you have your own car website too?
Definitely radio and print and website, all completely different. Even now for website, what you do on printed material is very detailed. For website, you have to go even more simple, simply because people don't want to sit on their phone for 2 hours reading your article. They don't want to sit 20 minutes. They don't want to sit 10 minutes. They want 5 minutes, 4 minutes. But with radio, you have to make it even more simple. That is not impossible, but it's a challenge.
You could have easily said, leave the car shows for the TV shows, but why did you decide to go on and using the radio as a medium, despite the obvious visual disadvantages?
Initially, when I started this 8 years ago, it was almost ridiculous. People thought I was actually, you know, trying to do something. It's like trying to explain a cooking show on radio. You know, people like to visually see their meat or vegetables or fish being prepared. But the car has become such a mainstay with, especially with Malaysians. And I don't think there's any other radio show like this in the region, or maybe not even in ASEAN countries. But the challenge is very simple. if you keep talking about it over and over and over, and if you make it lighthearted, and if you not script it, I've never done a scripted show. If you don't script it, it comes out naturally. People will be drawn to your show and they'll be drawn to your information.
Obviously, you've been talking about cars on radio for quite some time now. So how does it feel like doing this kind of specialized show in Malaysia that's pretty uncommon without any other car shows on radio to use as a benchmark?
I feel actually very proud that I've been given the opportunity by the station to let me do this. And hopefully others will see it as a benchmark for them to do it, because I think competition will always make me better. If I'm just the only one in town doing this or in the region, then I'm going to be very complacent. I need competition, and I'm asking others to please do this and compete with me and make me, you know, move my game up at least 5 notches.
Speaking of specialized and uncommon radio shows in Malaysia, another highly visual radio show that we used to have was Ticket to Ride. If you thought it was tough to get listeners to visualize cars, try visualizing an entire trip to different parts of the world, which was the whole premise of our travel show, Ticket to Ride.
Now, Eddie, you worked on this show with Azura, right?
That's right.
How did this idea for a travel show come about?
Because we love to travel. And Azura was thinking, why don't we come up with a travel show? And, you know, it would be the first on radio, right? Do you hear travel shows on
not
other
that
radio
I know
stations?
Of, you know.
No, right?
Not even,
so we want to be the first. We are Kiesu. We love to be the
not
first.
Not in Malaysia. Not even in Southeast Asia, in fact.
That's right. Yeah. So hence, you know, we did a fashion show. That's why we decided to do a travel show on a weekend show, because it's more of a lifestyle feel, right?
Mm, yeah, definitely. And on the phone right now with us, we have Azura Rahman, who used to present this show with us alongside Eddie. Now, Azura, on Ticket to Ride, you were selling a destination to listeners without any visual aid. It sure sounds like a tough sales job.
It really was a tall order in many ways, you know, because the premise of the show was armchair traveling, you know, taking listeners to far-flung corners of the earth without having to leave the comfort of their seat. Now, the trick was to do that sonically, you know, to evoke a sense of the place with sounds. So immediately from the get-go, we knew that this was going to require a certain amount of production magic. This included setting the scene with narration, a blinding soundtrack, and of course, great content. Now, we treated each episode as a journey in itself. So each episode of Ticket to Ride has a beginning, middle, and end, just like any journey one would undertake. Now, at the end of it, we hope that each listener had travelled to that destination with us just by tuning in.
Now, what's the screening process like for guests on the show? They may have visited a beautiful location, but I think they still require a certain level of storytelling ability to get the story across on air, right?
I guess as every BFMer would say, it's every producer's nightmare or challenge, I should say, getting great content. We relied on our contact books, of course, you know, of people who knew people who've been to great places recently, lots of ring rounds there. But also we came across lots of amazing content via Instagram just by stalking people's accounts. Now, the trick was trying to get equally amazing content to translate on air as how they may have displayed on Instagram, which of course was a visual platform. Now, prepping the guests became key, because we'd always say that they needed to paint a picture with words, to be descriptive, to stay away from generic words like, oh, it's nice. And of course, we fill in storytelling gaps with our own narration. There has been situations, though, where I've had to can interviews, have to chuck interviews away because, you know, it's amazing how some people can go to the most wonderful holidays, to the most exotic locations, and they just can't go beyond saying more than, it was great.
Was it tough to look for destinations that are slightly off the beaten track?
Now, you'd be very surprised. Malaysians are a well-travelled lot, you know. We've had guests who've been to North Korea, guests who've been embedded with the Malaysian army in Afghanistan, guests who've backpacked in deepest Iran. They've really done it all. As someone who has a serious case of wanderlust, it brought me so much joy listening to their stories, but also a serious case of envy. From the singing sands of Namibia to the temples in Bhutan, I really want to do it all. They've really inspired me, and it's just a matter of time before I get to live up my own Ticket to Ride.
That was Azura Rahman, former host of Style File and Ticket to Ride, giving us a glimpse of what it took to put together an episode of Ticket to Ride. And that was a whole segment discussing the process of turning what is visual into audio. We've been taking a look back at what has been on offer, but coming up, we look ahead. I will be joined in the studio by Ali Johan, who is the unofficial man in charge, I suppose, of destination programming, as well as our music lead on the station. Stay tuned to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. You are listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Lee Chui Lin. And for this hour, we are continuing our programming for our 10th birthday. Don't know if you're sick of hearing about it yet, but we sure aren't. It's going to keep going. So gear up. And in this hour, we have been taking a look at the contributions, the firsts, the lasts, the turning the visual into the audio, the entire experience of the weekend supplement. Joining me now is Ali Johan to look ahead.
Hello, Lynn.
Hello. Okay, so let's talk about this. You've been part of the weekend supplement for quite some time now, although I understand that you joined stating that you have an interest in business.
Totally. I love business. I don't know how I ended up doing programs for the weekend supplement.
The one show that doesn't do business.
Yeah.
So you were part of bringing it from that early roster of, you know, four shows to kind of the full experience that it is today. Tell us about that.
Well, we started with very little shows and with no intention to fill up your weekends with programs. But eventually, when we had more people in the team, we devised more and more programs that has always been outside of the business element of the shows we have from Monday to Friday, right? So this is that pull out in a newspaper, that special non-business segment in Time Magazine or Economist or whatever, right? And that's what we intended to do. We decided to go with things that we thought would work for radio on the weekends and, you know, hence the weekend supplement. So everything from a movie show to food show, culture, philosophy, lifestyle, the arts. So, yeah, everything that's not markets and stocks, you know.
Right. And as we've heard from, I guess, the rest of this hour, the shows on the weekend sound pretty distinct compared to the rest of the shows that you'll hear on the weekdays, which I guess there's more of what internally we would call texture, right? More
totally.
Clips, yeah. More music. Why was the decision made to go in that direction?
I feel like the topics that we speak about sometimes requires these textures. Most of these programs are visual in nature, right? A fashion show, a car show.
Cooking, even.
Yeah. And yeah, so these things needed that little bit more texture and production, actually, because the rest of the programs are mainly interview, one presenter and one guest, and that's it, live program. But we tried to add a bit more dynamics to it, I think, by producing and inserting clips, and wherever we can, we have sound bits going on. So it's a lot more production heavy, but also the nature of the shows requires this kind of treatment, I feel, because sometimes you wouldn't even be able to visualize these things. So these audio aids are helpful, I feel.
You've staked out a pretty resolute plot on the BFM landscape, I think, for the kinds of shows that you do, for being pretty, you know, so far sort of separate, I think, in many ways from the more business-heavy, news-heavy elements of the rest of the station. Do you see that being the same moving forward?
Actually, we feel like it's time that the programs on the weekend supplement also move in line with the station's direction. I mean, I'm not to say that we weren't together, but you could tell, you could sense the difference between a weekend supplement show and a weekday program.
You're like your own little republic.
Kind of.
Yeah.
And it's not great feeling that you are by yourself, especially post-GE14. Our program director and myself and everyone else in the station have sort of spoken about what we're going to be moving forward. These programs like Night School, like Wavelength, Bar None, Style File, I Love KL. And we want to have more news because that's what the station stands for at large. And we are very proud to be, you know, reporters of our circles, of our scenes, of our landscape, to say the least. So more news on like fashion news on Style File, sports news on Bar None, and KL news on I Love KL.
Right.
Things like that are going to be the way moving forward. We've started a little bit of that already if you've been listening to us recently. And that's the way moving forward. We want to try and merge or probably lift the great things that your other belts are doing in terms of getting news clips and content that's driven that way.
And you mentioned there that notion of being reporter on the ground for a scene. And I think that's kind of a crucial element of understanding what it is that you do on the weekend. Everybody is sort of their own specialist. There are very specific visions for each show. How do you plan to develop that further as we look forward to the next 10 years? What other reporters from what other scenes do you want to get?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. A lot of our programs have come to be by virtue of having a very strong and passionate presenter behind it. For instance, Fuad Rahmat on Night School and Cam with A Bit of Culture. And these two are examples of shows that are not easily replicated without the both of them I mentioned at the helm. So that's been always the case with the rest of the weekend supplement programs. Sometimes, I don't know if it's a fault or not, but we rely too much on the personalities running the program. And that will be difficult to sort of break out of. But also we love the fact that it's driven by these personalities. I don't know if it's healthy to just focus on specialized voices for programs because that limits us generally. But these specialized voices give the right context, I feel. So maybe we would like to find a middle ground of these two, you know, a bit more reporting on the ground type thing, but also done by or driven by people who know exactly where to look for and what to look for.
I'm looking forward to it. I want to see what happens in the next 10 years. I've been speaking to Ali Johan of The Weekend Supplement. You've been listening to just a little mini showcase of what The Weekend Supplement is all about and what they've brought to the station over the last decade. This is The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.